Calvin Smith is taking epistemology to the streets. Bigfoot, ancient alien technology, flat earth, the Illuminati. Better grab your tinfoil thinking fedora. It's Open Loops. You're listening. You're breathing. You're dreaming. You don't have to do anything because your unconscious mind is now tuning in for you to your favorite late night talk show for the shamelessly fringe. It's Open Loops with Greg Bornstein. Conversations that bend. Hello, everybody. Greg Bornstein here, your consciousness disruptor, your cultural hypnotist, your curator of experience, and of course, your chief looper. Open loops. What the heck is an open loop? We'll get to that in a minute. My job on this show is to challenge your existing belief systems by sharing radically unique ideas designed to stimulate your unconscious mind and force you to step into the highest version of yourself. We don't talk about normal things on this show. We talk about the taboo. We talk about the unexplained. We talk about the mysterious, the magical, the hypnotic, the fantastical, the conspiratorial, the secretive, the deepest questions, the biggest ones, and of course, who and what we really are. My guest today, Calvin Smith, is also dedicated to this question in a few ways. One, he's a musician. He's living the artistic life. But most importantly for this episode, Calvin Smith is the host of Unquestionable, a podcast that delves into many of the topics that we talk about here. Calvin was once a believer. Now he's more of a skeptic. But like me, he remains open-minded. He practices something called street epistemology, which we're going to get into in this episode. I probably treated Calvin like this was the last time I'd ever have him on, which clearly can't be true. I threw him everything. Bob Lazar, ancient alien technology, what's happening in Antarctica. A lot of things, a lot. Bigfoot, flat earth, a lot of things that he's brought up on his show, some things he hasn't covered on his show. What I like about Calvin is that he entertains both sides, the skeptical, the believers. Now, for those of you who are more of the believing side, listen to this man. That's what this whole thing is about. I've said it from the beginning. We have to have both sides in conversation with each other. There's too much of, if you believe it on this side, then you just listen to this content. Enough. We have to bridge the gap. It's only by questioning what can't be questioned, and then even questioning that, that we all evolve as people. Now, whether that evolution is spiritual or whether that's Darwin's, listen to this episode with Calvin and you can decide what makes more sense for you. I really like Calvin. I think he's a very smart gentleman. I love his perspective. I love his research. And just like me, we share this belief that these conversations need to be out there. Just because something might not hold up to scientific scrutiny, whatever that is, he'll tell you what that is. But, you know, I know some people question the dogmas of science too, which, sure, he could do a really interesting episode on. Actually, he probably should do an episode on that. But yes, just because something doesn't hold up doesn't mean it's not part of the public psyche and it's worth investigating. Why does it have to take a New York Times article about UFOs for us to talk about this? Human beings are talking about things in the sky they haven't seen for millions of years. It's out there. It's out there. Calvin isn't afraid to address it. And he's not afraid to admit that he doesn't know something. And that there are things that he thinks are still unexplainable. You'll hear it all. If you enjoy Open Loops, please make sure to share this podcast with your friends and family, as well as follow it on Apple Podcasts, and rate the show, leave a review. It definitely helps get the word out there, so I'm very grateful for that. Now, without further ado, are you ready to have your paradigms challenged? I certainly was. Here's Calvin Smith. Today on Open Loops, we have Calvin Smith. He's a musician, but also, and much more relevant to this show even, the host of Unquestionable with Calvin Smith, a podcast that, it's about the real questions we all need to know. Aliens visiting Earth? Was 9/11 an inside job? Is there a God? Is Bigfoot out there? He wants to share. He wants to report his findings. He wants to question his own beliefs and even delve deeper into some of the topics that we love talking about here on Open Loops. Calvin, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate it. And that was a really accurate breakdown of what I like to talk about. So I think you represented me well.
Oh, good. Good, good, good. Yeah, I'm curious. I mean, it's interesting that you said you're an agnostic, right?
Well, I would personally identify as atheist. I used to identify specifically as an agnostic atheist, which would essentially mean that I don't currently have, because the definition of atheism is the lack of belief in any god or gods. Right. So I lack a belief as in I don't have enough evidence to believe in any gods or gods, but I'm open to it and you can convince me. And I'm not saying that there is no God. It's saying that I just don't know, but I'm pretty sure as of right now that there's not, but convince me essentially. And so far there's not any new arguments that are compelling to me. Recently I've kind of dropped that agnostic kind of label. Actually within the past couple of weeks, I actually have been reading this book called The Manual for Creating Atheists by Peter Boghossian. And it's all about street epistemology. It's actually titled scarier than it actually is. It's actually a really good book. He actually talks about agnosticism a little bit in the first couple chapters and how, you know, you're not agnostic towards the belief of Santa Claus. You are 100% sure that there is no Santa Claus, but you're open to evidence of there being Santa Claus, but you know that there isn't one. You know, it's kind of a contradictory kind of thing agnosticism is. So he suggests people just drop the agnostic label. You know, if you're atheist, you're atheist. You don't believe, you know, you don't have enough evidence.
Yeah. So. Yeah, no, I mean, very early on for me, and I think I've talked about this maybe in the very early episodes of the show, but there became a point where what happened is I listened to that Penn Jillette. He did a thing for NPR.
Yeah.
About why he believes there is no God. I believe that's the way he put it. Mm-hmm. And the thing that stuck out to me was he wasn't saying he was an atheist. He was saying he comes from the default position that he just sees everything around him as nature. He seeks to understand it. He's working with scientists to figure out, not working, but working with the conversations that scientists have to figure out meaning in this world. And his position is that the idea of even introducing a god to then be atheist against is a whole different layer of understanding. He's just going with, I wake up every day, I see a tree, I don't know where it came from, I'm not sure. I think I understand based on nature. The idea that there's even a god, whether which there is or isn't to debate, is not even part of that. It's just, there's beauty I see before me, and I'm trying to understand it. So that, to me, was a different... I started going off of that philosophically, at the very least. Very early on, I started going, okay, yeah, I could keep reading these Richard Dawkins books and Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, all these guys that I did right. love when I was a freshman in college and really end of high school. I was really into the atheism, just really into it. But once I heard him talk about it that way, and also, I didn't want to become this religious zealot of atheism, which mm-hmm. is, I know it's the common criticism.
Right.
But I started questioning that and going, you know what? I don't think it's not this extreme either. It's not this anti-God, and it's not this pro-God. It's somewhere where I'm going to say, okay, I don't see any evidence. I personally haven't experienced any evidence. I don't see any big reason or feel that there's any big reason to bring on this invisible force. Therefore, I'm going to remain open and hope that something happens. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a really good kind of standpoint. I come from kind of the same kind of standpoint as to where I was getting for, I'm still pretty in the I guess the atheist community, I guess you could say.
Right.
I still, you know, try to participate in any activism or anything that's, you know, there's not a whole lot that goes on around me here in Southeast Michigan. So
yeah, I can't even imagine. Are they very religious over there?
If you go further south, like once you start hitting Ohio, so I'm about 45 minutes away from the Ohio border. Once you start getting towards Ohio is when you start seeing the Jesus signs and, you know, 8774 truth dot, you know, call this number
my
and stuff.
Gosh.
But you know, where I used to live, the previous apartment complex that I lived in, there were Jesus posters everywhere and, you know, everything like that. But I just wasn't really sure where I stood on my own beliefs. Like I wasn't sure if I was atheist. If someone asked me what I believed, I would say I don't know, but I guess I'm probably Christian because that's probably the best explanation. So I just didn't know, and so I was like, fuck it, I'm gonna pick up a Bible and I'm gonna see what it says. And picked it up, and it was a King James version, which is kind of hard to start off with, in my opinion, to read. It's right. A little hard to read, but I did my best. I did skip over a couple parts, which I'm actually reading over in a different translation that's a little easier to read, the New Living Translation. It's like third grade reading level, but it's like really, it's really easy to kind of take notes with. And I read the Bible, and I didn't like what it said. I just didn't like the things that it was saying about homosexuality, misogyny, and you know, how you should treat non-believers. Every slavery is just prevalent throughout the entire thing. It just wasn't sitting right with me. And that was my first kind of thing where I was like, first of all, I don't like this. Whether I believe in the God or not, I don't like what the book that he wrote says. And then I looked more into it and started watching programs like The Atheist Experience through the Atheist Community of Austin, and watching street epistemology videos with Anthony Magnabosco and Cordial Curiosity, who I actually just had Anthony Magnabosco on my show, and that episode's coming out on Wednesday.
Oh, that's awesome.
And we
talked
all about street epistemology, which is kind of the basis for my show.
I want to get into that next.
Yeah, and with the atheism thing, I was just getting too, like, firebrand atheist. I was getting to where, I wanted to debate people and be like, kind of, you're stupid for believing God. You know, that's kind of where I was.
Yeah.
But after I started watching people like Anthony Magnabosco, who has a way more different approach. And like people like Peter Boghossian with his book, A Manual for Creating Atheists, and talking about street epistemology, it's a more opening and welcoming way to have conversations like these without the debate. It's you're feeling better about the conversation and your interlocutor is feeling better about the conversation. And you both may have a better understanding of what you're even talking about, because a lot of people don't realize what they even believe in until they say it out loud. Because a lot of people don't even talk about it. They go to church and that's it. That's all they ever talk about. They don't talk to atheists or non-believers about it and have them, you know, question them. Like, honestly, why do you believe this? What convinced you on a scale from 0 to 100%? How confident are you? What would change your confidence? You know, it's just simple questions, and you're not forcing your belief on them. And it's a lot more of a better way to get down to truth and figure out who has the right idea, whether it's about religion or aliens, whether, you know, I don't know if someone has evidence about Bigfoot that I don't know about, you know, approach me and present it. Let's talk about it.
So wait a minute, let's get into street epistemology. Yeah, sure. That sounds very, very intriguing. Anytime you throw the word street and sit in front of anything philosophical, it's a, oh yeah, I'm going to take you to town, mister. Right. I love that. I love that. Street epistemology. I think I'm a street existentialist among my friends.
Okay.
I don't know, just any opportunity to talk about how bleak I think my life is. What do you mean by street epistemology, and or what does Peter mean, and how have you interpreted it in your life?
So street epistemology it's a Socratic method of questioning. So basically Socrates, you know the philosopher way back when in Greece, he kind of developed this message of where he would literally stand out on the side of the street and do this. He would ask people, you know, what do you want to talk about? You know, like, what do you think about these laws going on? What do you think about that? You know, just simple questions. It would be like 5-minute conversations, and he would do that all day. He would have really philosophical conversations with people. And so Peter Boghossian, Dr. Peter Boghossian, he picked up this method, and he thought that it was a really good way to get to the basis of why people believe in God. That's specifically what the book A Manual for Creating Atheists is about. It's all about God beliefs. But the cool thing about street epistemology is that you can actually use it towards any belief. You can use these Socratic questions towards, you know, why do you believe in Bigfoot, aliens? How do you feel about gun control, abortion? You know, do you think Jesus rose from the dead after 3 days? Why? It's a really interesting way. And I feel like people gain a better understanding once they're talking to someone who is coming to them unbiased and they're saying their opinions out loud. So with street epistemology, a big thing is repeating the answers back to the interlocutor, because that way they can kind of hear their own thoughts said back to them from a third person view. So it's a little bit, they kind of hear if it sounds crazy, I guess you could say.
And
It's just me saying it back to them that goes, wow, that sounds really crazy when you say it like that. You know, it doesn't sound right. And you investigate it, and sometimes they're 5-minute conversations, sometimes they're 30-minute conversations. And I'm gaining the materials myself to where I can actually go out into parks and public places and actually practice this, because, you know, that's the best way you're going to have these conversations with total strangers.
I was going to ask, have you done it? Have you been doing this recently? I mean, things are slowly opening up, but it sounds that, I wonder, do you have any examples or experiences?
Yeah, so that's the thing is, when I first found this method and found Anthony Magnabosco's work, it was in the middle of the pandemic. You know, you couldn't go out and talk to people. So I was like, oh, crap. But I guess I have time until things open up to study this and hone my skills and try to practice. I don't know, maybe with family members or something I would try.
Yeah.
Problem is that not a lot of family members talk to me. So I don't have a lot of people to practice this with. And my wife herself is, you know, same way, she's skeptic, atheist. She doesn't have any beliefs. So I can't really have any belief conversations with her either. So what I do is I hop on the chat site Omegle. And sifting through all of the inappropriate things, you actually can have some really insightful conversations with people. I've had 2-3 hour long conversations with people about what they believe and why, everything from flat earth to, you know, why they believe in ghosts, God. It's really interesting. So that's what I've been doing as opposed to going out, because I don't have all the equipment on me yet, because I'm in the process of moving. So I can't afford to get the equipment at the moment to actually go out and bring my stuff out and talk to people in person. But Omegle actually is not a terrible method to practice it. You know, you have to deal with some people just hitting skip on you out of nowhere.
Yes.
You know, just trolling you or something. But honestly, I've had some really interesting conversations.
That's so interesting. Yeah. I remember when Chat Roulette first came out.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, for those that you don't know, Omegle is, it's kind of, the best way to put it is it's speed dating with video in a way.
Yeah.
And some people lean a little probably too far in the dating direction with it, in the sense that it's video and people are, you know, when you're on the internet and you're on video, people are going to be, yes, doing some interesting things. But I very much enjoyed, I think what was fun about Chat Roulette when it first dropped, and I was in college at the time, was the variety of the different kinds of conversations you could have. You could speak with, I remember there were people playing music and you could listen to music. There were people just looking to meet people all over the world, and it was random, and they toss you. So yes, you are going to, it's the internet, you're going to have to deal mostly with sex, and mostly males who's so just be aware of that. But that said, I think it is a interesting alternative to going out and talking to random people in the park.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, besides that too, because what's cool is Omegle actually recently updated. Now they actually, because they used to have two different selections where you could pick inappropriate, so that it's totally unfiltered and anyone can pick, you know, anyone can find anyone, or they had somewhat censored. So they had like moderators that would pop in once in a while, and you know, they'd ban people.
Oh, that's great.
Their stuff showing. But they actually recently updated and they completely got rid of the inappropriate section. Now it's purely moderated. So now actually inappropriate stuff is a little less common on there.
That's awesome.
And you have to like click a bunch of like terms of use. Like I agree to this and this and this, you know, you have to be this old to use it. So, you know, you have to go through a bunch of clicks to even start talking to people now, which has helped a little bit.
I think that's great.
Yeah. And then other than Omegle, there's also a Street Epistemology Discord server too, which you can actually pop on there. And there's a bunch of people who are practicing street epistemology, and all of them have beliefs. And they literally, a couple times a day, they're like, hey, pop on this server with me and let's talk about gun control. You know, and that's a good way to practice street epistemology with people who are actually serious about it too. So that, I would suggest the Discord server for anyone who is interested in learning a little bit more as well.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting.
Yeah.
With regard to, so you have this, I guess, non-belief framework that you come from. And then you're going into your show. I mean, here's my question with this. When it comes to what inspired you to do your podcast, where you're looking at psychic readings and UFO incidents, are you coming in from a position of skepticism as default? What is your take? How did you want to approach this in a journalistic way, or maybe not a journalistic way, your opinionated way? I mean, what were you thinking?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, is I used to be a big believer in literally everything I want to talk about. I used to be the crazy tinfoil hat guy who thought Hillary Clinton was a lizard person. I thought, you know, there were lizard people living under the earth and the earth was probably flat and that we probably hadn't been to the moon, you know, all these, literally any conspiracy you can think of, I fully believed it. And I was writing blogs about it.
Wait a minute. Let's go back to that phase. Wait, tell me, when did that first happen for you? How'd you get into that?
Okay. So all my life, ever since I was a kid, my sisters specifically have always been like, ooh, aliens, you know? So like I used to read these little alien books or whatever when I was a kid. So it always kind of was sitting in the back of my mind. And I've always been like, ooh, look out for Dogman, you know, because the Michigan Dogman is a thing.
Yes.
So I'm like, ooh, watch out for Dogman outside, you know? And I was legitimately scared of this dog person that was outside. And ghosts and skinwalkers and all these. So I used to fully believe all of that. You know, and I basically, I had a desk job where I literally had nothing else better to do but to listen to YouTube videos and podcasts, audiobooks, while I'm sitting there looking at my computer screen. And that's kind of where the big sprout kind of happened, is I was listening to tons and tons of information that was unreliable. It was YouTube videos. It was, you know, random people on Facebook. It was weird Facebook groups that are totally confirmation biased. And I was getting my information from the wrong places. Yeah. And I wasn't. So when I decided I didn't really know what I believed religiously, and I picked up the Bible, I decided I was atheist. I said, okay, so if I am saying that I'm atheist towards this God, I need to apply that same skepticism towards all of my beliefs. You know, I need to question, just like the way I'm questioning God, I need to question the aliens and the Bigfoots. And I need to question this and really think about it and look at the evidence from both, the evidence and the non-evidence, I guess you could say. And so it kind of led me out of that belief. And I don't know if I believe that aliens are flying around right now. I don't know how sure I am about that anymore. I fully do not believe in Bigfoot. I've been banned from just about every Bigfoot group on Facebook because I'm just simply asking for evidence and nobody has any. Frankly. So, I mean, I just was banned from one yesterday, actually.
When you say nobody has any, I mean, you know, people always bring up, you know, oh, look at the you know, the video. Look at this, mm-hmm. The famous video.
Videos, yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
where's the poop? Where's the dead bodies? Where's the bones? You're telling me a Bigfoot hasn't gotten hit by a car ever once in history? He's never fallen off of a cliff. He's never gotten shot by a hunter. He's never, you know, all we have is these footprints and blurry videos. Really? Like, really? And empty peanut butter jars, you know, like that's what we're calling evidence. Why aren't we? The thing is that every time we've tested DNA evidence of supposed Bigfoot, every single time it's come back as a different animal. It's come back as an animal we already know of every single time. So there has been never any DNA evidence that has confirmed anything besides what we already know of. So it's like I'm just having a hard time with the evidence. You know, I'm open to it, totally open to it. But I just, it's all the same stuff. It's just blurry videos and footprints.
Do you think there are people in suits in those videos, or do you think it's just chimps or gorillas?
I think a lot of the time it's either people just minding their own business in the forest, and they, you know, might be wearing some sort of clothing that makes them look weird from a distance. Because, you know, if you want to find Bigfoot, you're going to find something that looks like Bigfoot to you.
Yes.
You have to. Yes. You can't start at the conclusion that Bigfoot exists. You know, you have to start at the conclusion to where you have to let the evidence lead you to Bigfoot. And just for me, the footprints very easily manipulated and faked. I think most of the time it is honestly people just faking it with some sort of gorilla suit or something for the hype, for the views, for the likes. You know, I don't know.
Why do you think I've always been confused, and I've said this to people that are intrigued by cryptozoology on my show. What do you think it is about Bigfoot that endures? I mean, to me, it seems like the most uninteresting of all the paranormal stuff. We have gorillas. We have these. I mean, is it just that there's supposedly myths about it in old cultures, and I'm questioning if American Indians and Native Americans, you know, if that's even, I'm saying both because I forget what the proper term is these days. Is it American Indians? I think it is.
I you know, honestly, I don't know. Because
someone fact check me on this. I apologize for screwing this up,
right,
everybody.
Yeah, same.
The people who were here before, you know, I don't even know if there are actual legends of this Bigfoot. I mean, have you done a deep dive into this, the origins of Bigfoot, and why there's so many people that are obsessed with it in the paranormal community?
Well, there are in multiple society, because I mean, I did it's been a long time since I've dived into it, but you know, when I was wearing my tinfoil hat, I did my fair share of Bigfoot research, and I don't know. To me, I believe that it starts off, it actually in Native American tradition. I believe that there's a lot of Native American traditions of big hairy ape men and, you know, skinwalkers and, you know, paranormal types of figures. And that's the thing, is that for me, the plural of anecdote isn't evidence. So, I mean, the fact that they can write it down and that they write down that they see these things, that's not enough. It's no different than looking at the Bible for evidence of God. You know, you're looking at these ancient Indian writings for evidence of Bigfoot, and you can't do that. You need the evidence. You need the poop. You need the DNA. You need, it's once again starting off at the belief that Bigfoot exists, as to, you know, that's like starting off that Thor exists. It's just a story, but, you know, that's if there's evidence that leads to Thor, then, I mean, evidence leads to Thor, and Thor is the god of thunder, you know, so Thor is making thunder because we can prove this. We have evidence to prove that. No evidence for Bigfoot so far.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I mean, this is something that I don't think people think enough about, the idea that if we right now were to get wiped off this planet, but all the text evidence was left behind and humans were to start again and look at the entire fiction section of any Barnes and Noble, it's so easy to go, I mean, they might not know what the word fiction is, that they could interpret that to being just truth in this new culture. They could look at everything and go, oh my gosh, look at what they had. Look at, you know, I mean, oh, there used to be this clown that ran around and terrorized kids, and the ritual of, you know, I mean, all of Stephen King's stuff, people could say was life, which is a good point with the Sumerian tablets. Why does everybody just assume that tablet in Sumeria is truth? Why isn't it fiction? Why that's the thing that has always confused me about the Ancient Aliens people. What are your thoughts on that?
I cannot stand Ancient Aliens, to be completely honest. Like, I I was just talking to Anthony Magnabosco about this too, and I never on my show, okay, I talk about the pyramids and ancient technology, which I'm sure we can get into that in a little bit, but I have said multiple times in my show, don't watch Ancient Aliens for at least reliable information. They say everything is aliens, literally everything. And then they repeat their episodes for 20 something seasons. And
yes,
there's a couple things that they say that are really interesting, but I've had, you know, I've had people on my podcast who've been on Ancient Aliens, like Brian Forrester has been on Ancient Aliens. And,
he's a believer.
I kind of even talked to him in my episode. I had him on my second episode, and I kind of talked to him. I said, do you think that aliens like built the pyramids, or are these elongated skulls that you're researching? And he said that he just doesn't know. He's open to it, but he, you know, it's definitely not what we think it is. It's not the common consensus to what we think it is, but it could be extraterrestrial. But to me, there's no evidence of it being extraterrestrial. I feel like it's evidence that he's studying, and people like Graham Hancock and Robert Schock are studying. I feel like there's sufficient evidence to show that we were able to create some sort of technology, but it's just lost, and we just don't know what happened to it.
That's interesting. Yeah, I was going to say, it would be very easy for you to just do a show where you have people on that completely are skeptical, completely debunk everything. But the idea that you had Brian Forrester on makes me go, what is Calvin trying to prove here? What is your inner game with all this? Yeah. Because, I mean, Brian Forrester, he's got books about lost ancient technology of Peru and talks about this cataclysm and starts getting into a lot of beliefs that people in the ancient technology, ancient aliens community believe. I mean, Brian Forrester is often a name that people are very much, they revere in the community. You know, so my, I guess my question is this. Did you walk away from that interview more open to ideas than the common skeptic?
Oh yeah. I mean, to be fair, I've been a fan of Brian Forrester for many years, ever since I had that desk job and I started, you know, cause that's the thing is that I was learning about ancient lost technology and finding out about Brian Forrester because of Ancient Aliens and, you know, these other programs like Gaia and such.
Yeah.
But the thing is that the evidence that Brian Forrester and all these other independent researchers have is strong enough to where I believe them rather than the common consensus. I mean, that's the thing is that they have evidence to show. And that's the difference between this and like a Bigfoot belief is that these ancient technology people like Graham Hancock and Robert Duvall and John Anthony West, they have actual testable, demonstrable evidence. Like they have PowerPoints, they have, you know, math equations, whatever the hell you want, they have the evidence and they show it in these presentations, and yet they're labeled a pseudoscientist. But, it just doesn't make sense to me as to why like modern Egyptology would not welcome this new evidence. Because I mean, trust me, I don't want to believe in ancient technology and that, you know, we had some sort of thing, some sort of machinery that was able to cut and carve these intricate stones, which I have pictures and stuff that I could actually screen share with you if you were interested. And I could, but it's just the evidence is pointing towards this ancient technology or something that we just don't know about. I'm not suggesting that they had some laser beams or that they had, you know, were levitating stuff with their mind or anything. Yeah. It was very practical machinery that they were using to create these things. And it's lost. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis or anything.
What's that?
Okay. So that's kind of the big basis for this ancient lost technology is the Younger Dryas hypothesis. So it's not even really a hypothesis. So the Younger Dryas is actually a period that did happen. And it lasted for approximately, I think it was 1,200 to 1,600 years. And so about 12,800 years ago, there was a sudden cooling of the Earth. So it basically, you know, created a mini ice age. And there was a sudden warming at about 11,600 years ago that caused this ice to melt at a significant rate, whether that be a meteor, which there's actually evidence that was recently discovered within the past 5 or 6 years of a meteor impact site in I think it was west of Greenland. And it could have caused this massive melting that wiped out a civilization that quite possibly could have been here at least 10,000 plus years ago. And right now the common consensus is that civilization as we know it basically started with like the Sumerians and ancient Egyptians around 6,000 years ago, somewhere around there. But this would push back the day of humanity, you know, back an extra 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 years. And that's kind of where the basis is with this, the Younger Dryas is what wiped out this technology.
Interesting.
And this society. Yeah.
Yeah. So then, I mean, look, I am kind of curious because it gets weird. There's a weird line between magic and actual technology. And I've heard Graham Hancock talk about stones that could cut through other stones. I forget what is it? It's kind of like a Sith, but it's a tournament. You know that word? It's a
specific
stone. Yeah,
I totally forget what it's called.
But it sounded very magical, this idea that the stone could cut through. So, I mean, that to me does speak of magic in a way. What are some of the things that that evoke the Arthur C. Clarke quote? Indistinguishable from magic technology back then. Is there anything that you've found in your research from Brian Forrester or any of the ancient aliens people that, or at least the ancient astronaut? Ancient civilization theorists that have brought evidence that you think, wow, yeah, no, this is advanced technology that we might consider magical today.
Yeah. So a couple things that are just kind of jumping out to me off the top of my head would be tube drill holes. There's evidence of tube drill holes that are found all throughout, specifically in Egypt, but really throughout the entire world. And it's interesting because these tube drill holes, they're so precise and they're so well cut that it literally isn't possible to do with what really the method that ancient Egyptian researchers would say that they're doing is that they basically got this tubular rock and they essentially made this twine that, you know, I don't know if you've seen like a fire starter, you know, where they're pulling back and forth and it's kind of drilling into the wood to make fire. That's essentially what they're saying happened with these tube drill holes. But that's not the case. People like, I think his name was Charles Flanders, I want to say is his name. He was somewhere in the early or mid 1800s to 1900s, I want to say, is when he was researching these tube drill holes. And in his book, he actually wrote, there's this tube drill core. So they actually, where the holes are in these granite rocks, the actual core to them is actually sometimes sitting right beside them. So you can actually look at the tube drill cores and see the actual striations in the rock to see how they cut it. And it's cut in like a drill type of formation, like a screw, how it kind of winds down the screw. It's cut like that on these tube drill holes. So it was one single motion that was moving down these tube drill holes and cutting them out. So it wasn't going back and forth and chopping it out. And he has tons and tons and tons of evidence, including that. People like Uncharted X, who is a YouTuber and podcaster, he covers tube drill holes a lot. That's his big inspiration for ancient technology, is researching how the hell did we make these holes with, needless to say, out of granite, too. Granite is a 7 out of 10 on the Mohs hardness scale of rocks. So it's a really freaking hard rock to cut. And if you're using granite or dolerite or diorite or something like that, that's the same hardness, it would take you damn near 10 years to cut a couple inches out of it. And I even did an episode on this thing called the Unfinished Obelisk in Aswan, Egypt. And I think it's a 1600 pound obelisk. So like the Washington Monument is an obelisk. And the only evidence of how it was carved, and it's still partially attached to the bedrock, it would have been the biggest obelisk in existence if it was ever finished. And the only evidence of how they were carving it are these little dolerite balls that are sitting all around. And they're saying that they were essentially just using their bare hands to hit this and carve it. But there's literally no evidence on it of that happening. And what's interesting too is beside that obelisk, they have a giant piece of granite bedrock. You can actually, as a tourist, grab a dolerite ball and actually do this. You can actually test it. And for 20 years, that same granite slab has been sitting there and not a dent has been made out of it. And so how were they doing it way back then? It just makes no sense to me.
Yeah. Now I that's interesting that that's one way of definitely going, okay, the fact that this was created raises questions.
Right.
Have you ever found any evidence of what the technology is that's compelling to you?
Well, one interesting piece that really sticks out to me and that I kind of talked to Brian Forrester about is this thing called the schist disc. And the schist disc, I can't even really describe it. It's such a weird object. And I believe it was found in Peru. I could be wrong about that, but I think it was found in Peru. And it looks like a car steering wheel, kind of. But it has like these wings that kind of curve inside. And it's made out of I think it's actually made out of schist, which is a type of rock. And frankly, it's so brittle to where it would have been nearly impossible for them to form this really weird object. And I really can't even describe how weird it is. And it looks like a piece of machinery, but it's in the middle of this just ancient civilization. It's really an enigma, and we still don't quite know what it was used for. I guess common research is saying that it was used as like a dinner plate, but that'd be the weirdest freaking dinner plate and most totally useless dinner plate. But I guess there was some testing done on it. Someone printed a 3D model, you know, 3D printed model of it, and they actually put it into a vacuum and they spun it. And it actually creates a weird resonance of sound directly in front of it once it's rotating. So there's a little bit of woo-woo theory where maybe they had some sort of, you know, levitation technology or something like that, because it does create a weird sound resonance in front of it, which sound can, you know, levitate things. That's been proven in a lab where you can use sound to levitate things. So I don't know, were they doing that? That's a little woo-woo for me and not quite solid enough for me to believe, but it's interesting. And I feel like we should, you know, do more testing on it and look more into it. But that's probably the biggest thing. And besides that, there's weird things like Brian Forster is really into the elongated skulls in South America and in Peru specifically. The weirdest thing I've ever seen in my entire life is a thing called the Sushuti fetus. And we talked about this on the podcast. It doesn't exist anymore. I believe it was lost or destroyed or something, but there's drawings of it, you know, from when it, you know, artistic interpretations of it from when it was once around and being studied. And what's crazy is this thing looks like a little person. It's about, I don't know, a couple inches tall, and it has teeth. And it has fully developed eyes, and it has an elongated skull. But this is a fetus. It was found inside of a mummified pregnant woman. But it has fully developed teeth. It has all 32 teeth.
But that it was a very strange
inside of a woman, and the woman also had an elongated skull as well. Not to mention. So what was that thing? Why did it have teeth and fully developed? They said it was equivalent to a toddler, like its bone structure was like toddler structure, but it was a fetus. So that would be the first of any type of deformity that I've ever heard of. I've never heard of a deformity that fully develops your bones and teeth to toddler and elongates your skull at the same time. Kind of weird to me. And the fact that these elongated skulls most of the time have two sutures, two pinholes in the back of their heads. That's not found in us today. Like if you were to cut open my head, you wouldn't find two bullet holes in the back of my head like almost every elongated skull does. Not to mention how our skull is separated into like three. You know, there's one suture all the way down the middle, and then there's two smaller sutures on our forehead. With these elongated skulls, they're missing the middle suture. They only have this half moon at their forehead. They don't have this middle suture. So that wouldn't happen if they were really just being born and laying them down on a, because how they were elongating these skulls is they would lay down infants and they'd usually put a piece of board in between them and they'd lay there for about 2-3 years and it would actually develop their skull to elongate. And that's fine and cool, but that isn't what evidence is showing for these specific Peruvian elongated skulls. They are what look to be naturally elongated, like they were born that way or they developed that way naturally. And the sutures in the back of the head and the fact that it's missing the suture in the middle is something that isn't seen anywhere else in the world.
See, this is interesting, Calvin. You sound less like a skeptic the deeper we go into this specific field.
Because, I mean, trust me, I'm a skeptic, but I go where the evidence leads me. You know, if the evidence is leading me towards, you know, flying UFOs and, you know, the fact that they were lifting shit with their mind, then that's where the evidence leads. You know, I'm open to it. But the evidence is pointing towards this fetus with elongated skull, schist disc found in the same area. And then there's, you know, weird enigmas around like Pumapunku and how they carved their rocks. And they, you know, the fact that their giant H blocks are magnetic, these giant rocks are just magnetic and they totally shouldn't be. They're not made of any magnetic material, yet they are magnetic themselves and emit an electromagnetic field. Like, what the hell? How did they do that? How did they know they were doing that?
I know, and mainstream academia does not. I mean, these people, you're right about Brian Forrester, and I know Stephen and Evan Strong, who I definitely would love to. Yeah, I bet you could have a great interview with both of them. In Australia, our ancient alien ancestry, they are. I mean, they are. They've been shunned out of the Australian community of people looking into ancient ruins over there and stuff like that. Even though they said to me that some of them who are in the community have said, yeah, no, what you found there, what it's very special, these skulls. It's we just they're just not gonna let you talk about it. So there is this. Well, actually, let me ask you this. Based on your research, do you think there is some agenda in academia to get this stuff suppressed? And if so, what do you think that agenda is?
I don't think that there's an agenda to specifically shut it down, and shut down these pseudoscientists like Graham Hancock and Brian Forrester and Randall Carlson, who've spent damn near their whole life studying this and have hard evidence to show for it. And I think it's more so that they're not open to new evidence, is that we have what's in the textbooks. The textbooks say the Sphinx is 4,500 years old, so that's how it's staying. Textbook says we started 6,000 years ago in Sumeria, and that's kind of where the main European civilization started, from Sumeria. So that's how it's going to stay. That's not science, in my opinion. Science is always being open to new evidence and always being willing to change your mind. And there's actually a documentary called Mysteries of the Sphinx, which you can actually watch on YouTube. It's kind of hard to find, but you can find it if you type in Mysteries of the Sphinx. And I even linked it in one of my past episodes somewhere. But it shows John Anthony West and Robert Schoch, who both are studied the Sphinx and have hard evidence that the Sphinx is older than 4,500 years old. It's probably closer to 9 to 10,000, which would match up with the Younger Dryas impact. And they
Interesting.
presented this actually at some sort of peer review, like convention type of thing. And there's video of them there and presenting it, and everyone's calling them a pseudoscientist, that they're crazy. There's no evidence for this, when literally the evidence is right there. Like, he's looking at the evidence and he's saying that it's not evidence. And
That's crazy.
it's not science. That's not science, you know? Why would Robert Schoch risk his entire career to say these things? Why would Brian Forrester? Why would anybody do this, you know? Robert Schoch was a complete skeptic. Dr. Robert Schoch, he totally didn't think that the Sphinx was any older than 4,500 years old. He thought it was bullshit. But John Anthony West was like, come on out to the Sphinx. I want to hear what you have to say about these weird erosions on the Sphinx and the Sphinx enclosure. So he invites Robert Schoch out. He goes in, okay, fine, I'll go look. I've never been to Egypt. Free trip to Egypt. Why not? Flies there. He said within 130 seconds of looking at the Sphinx, he knew for a fact that it was older than 4,500 years old. Said within 130 seconds, it's all it took. And it's once you know what you're looking for and what you're looking at, it's just so blatant in front of you. I mean, the fact that these fissures and like the Sphinx enclosure, Robert Schoch said himself that these vertical fissures around the enclosure could only have been done by a significant amount of precipitation over thousands of years, which that would have happened if there was a Younger Dryas impact hypothesis where this meteor hit, caused massive flooding, wiped out the civilization, and carved into the rocks of the Sphinx enclosure. And that matches up with the timeline that they're hypothesizing. So it's really interesting. Like, why would they say this if they were scared about losing their entire job, their grants? You know, why would they say this?
Well, look, you know that this is all it's very compelling stuff that you've talked about, Calvin. You really know these topics in and out, so yeah, you're bringing it, or at least things that I've heard in different pieces, you're putting together to me in a way that's very it's a good package. You put it together well. No,
That's
this is
good.
good. Yeah,
Sometimes I'm
no.
scatterbrained. Sometimes I'm like, yeah, I have my days where I'm like, what the hell am I talking about? Like, I'll record an episode like three or four times of like, I did a Sphinx episode completely talking about the evidence for that. So, I mean, if you want, you're welcome to check out that, where I really dove deep into the Sphinx.
Yeah. No, we're going to link to your show for sure, yeah, because for sure. I want people to definitely check this out and engage in these conversations.
There's not a whole lot of people talking about this. And that's the thing, is that I want a lot more people to talk about street epistemology and being able to have cordial conversations and being able to talk about the possibility of ancient lost technology and talk about the possibility of aliens and possibility of flat earth. I had a flat earther on and I talked for her for 2.5 hours and I still message her every single day and she's still sending me stuff, you know? So
yeah. What did you walk away with that? I was going to ask, flat earth. Do you, you believed in it at one point, right? You were into it. Where did you start? And then where's this flat earther taking you?
Okay. So I'm a little weary saying that I don't know, because for a good week or two, probably a good week or two, when I had my tinfoil hat time, and I was pretty sure that the earth was flat. Everything that I was looking at was making really good sense. And I was, thing is I was only watching YouTube videos, And I was like, this stuff is making a lot of sense. These guys really have a lot to say. And, you know, why does that work like that? How come, you know, flight patterns are like that? It's so weird. You know, why do these videos of people walking on the moon look so weird? Why is there no shadows or something like that? Or why are their shadows so long? And I kind of believed it. But then I started off at the moon landing and I was like, I need to know if we were on the moon, man. That's my main thing, is I need to know if we went to the moon. And I read a ton of peer-reviewed papers. I know a lot of flat earthers are against it, but I went to NASA.com and I read a ton of their evidence that they have. And the thing is that not only NASA, but the evidence for flat earth is stronger than flat earth. It's more, the flat earth woman that I talked to, her name was Robin. She's so nice. She still sends me stuff every day. And, you know, I watch it, but it's honestly all the same kind of arguments that, you know, you listen to these people making the claims, and then you can just go into Google quite literally and type it up, and, you know, there's science articles and peer review papers and, you know, government websites that you can read where there was intensive research done to show this. And a lot of the times flat earthers say that Occam's razor is the, you know, that's what it is. It's Occam's razor. The easiest solution is the solution, essentially. So it's easier to look outside and see that the earth is flat. You look and it looks flat. You know, it looks like, you know, stars don't move. So we're not moving. We're not spinning. We're not flying through space at millions of miles, you know, light years per hour. We're just stationary plane. That's Occam's razor, is the easiest explanation. However, if you eliminate Occam's razor, which a lot of philosophers and researchers are nowadays, because the easiest solution is not always the solution. It may be harder to reach a little bit, but with just a little bit more research, you'll find that globe earth has far more evidence for it. And the fact that we have like literally been to space, and I just watched five people fly into space just a week ago.
Yes.
But a lot of them would say that that wasn't space. That was the upper atmosphere, which is basically space. So
What are people saying with flat earth when we get these photos from the moon of what the planet looks like, or these photos?
They're fake.
It's all fake. That's the idea.
It's all fake. It's composite photos. It's fisheye lens. It's CGI. It's a stage set. You name it. They I've heard all of them.
What's the agenda behind it, or at least what do they think? Why make the Earth round instead of flat? What is the thing that is being hidden by telling everybody, oh no, of course it's round?
Yeah, it's everything I've heard is for control. But to me, it makes no sense, because if tomorrow NASA came out and said, look guys, we effed up, we're not round, we've been lying this whole time, the earth is flat, we're stationary, here's the proof of it, I would say great, and then I would just go to work, I would just go do my job, and I would record my podcast, I would still, you know, do my, I would just say, okay, cool, great, earth is flat, there's the evidence, great, anyways, you know. I feel like a lot of people are kind of like that. Like, it's not going to be like, oh my God, the earth is flat. Boom. You know, it's,
Yes.
Stupid. No one's, or very, very few people will do that.
Do you think that's the case with the alien thing, too? That's the thing we always hear, right? The government, even with the release of this new UFO report, the UAP report, that they're not releasing the real stuff. Because if we really knew how much the government has been tracking and dealing with extraterrestrials for hundreds and hundreds of years now, that humanity would go crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do think, if anything, I don't think it, because the same thing with aliens, if aliens came down, landed, and were like, hey, we're here, that's it, and, you know, they flew away, did their thing, cool, great, I would still go to work, I would, you know, I wouldn't quit my job, I would still have to feed my wife, you know, I still got pets to feed, you know, I still have stuff to do, you know, I'm just going to know or believe that aliens are here, that's it, you know, that's all it's going to change, it's not going to affect my life necessarily, unless, I don't know, aliens start blowing shit up, I guess. Which would be a problem. Yeah. But I think that if anything, the religious community might take a little bit of a stand back, because I've heard from some Christians that the discovery of extraterrestrials would play a factor in their faith. But then I've heard other people, like evangelical Christians and, you know, Muslims, for example, who have said that UFOs are archangels and they're actually trying to present themselves and show us the word of God, and we're just being too aggressive and scary, and so they're not touching down or reaching us. So, and it's like, okay, well, where's the evidence for that? You know, how do you know that? How do you know that that's right. Not an angel? I don't. It's a UFO. It's an unidentified flying object. Anything in the sky that you don't know what it is an unidentified flying object. It's I don't know.
Yeah,
but
no, I one of the best episodes of Penn and Teller's BS was where they did evolution versus creationism. And at the end of the episode, their whole point was they were talking about one of the religions. It could have even been Scientology. I forget it. But they were talking about how, you know, okay, so they have intelligent design versus evolution. And then they were going, but then again, there's this other religion. And if you look back, they believe that there is a god in the sky, or who's actually an extraterrestrial lizard king. And this king is the person that's in charge of all of this, and da-da-da-da-da. And they go, yeah. What's interesting is that if you look at that argument versus intelligent design, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
And that to me really hit me hard as a high schooler. I was going, oh my gosh, yeah, I guess you're right. It's kind of, you can put anything in there, right. The flying spaghetti monster, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, give all these powers to it, but is the evidence pointing to it? Now, look, what do you think about this, though? The idea that people like us that are looking for rational arguments for magic are going to fail. And here's what I mean. I've had people in my life say, Greg, you won't experience this stuff. You won't know that it's true until you experience it. That's what people say about God. They say, God, it's not something you can rationally argue. God, you have to experience it. You have to know it to be true. I mean, I guess that runs into a lot of epistemological debate, but I'm curious. I mean, how do you do you walk around with that reality? Because it's definitely something I question about myself in terms of how much I could say that reality isn't magical.
Yeah, I mean, for me, if like God was real and he wanted me to know he existed, he knows exactly what it would take to convince me. And I'm open to it. You know, if you're listening, give me something, you know, pop up on the computer screen. Like I want to know, you know, I want to know. But that's my thing, is that how do I know which God is the right one? You know, because the same argument that the Christian is going to bring, saying that, you know, Jesus, you know, died for 3 days and you know, rose and ascended into heaven for you. As opposed to the Muslim would come up to me and say the same thing for their religion, or a Hindu would come up and say the same thing for their gods. And it's like, how do I know which one is correct? If I'm going to follow a religion and follow a God, I want to know which one is the right one. So what convinces you of this religion but makes this other one sound ridiculous. What is that? Why? Mm. You know, why does this sound ridiculous, but a massive flood that consumed the entire earth that for some reason the Egyptians had no idea was going on?
Right.
You know, because that's the whole story of Noah's flood. It really drives me crazy. I love talking about Noah's flood because just the fact of how unrealistic it was. And I mean, it's just like how, I want to know why people believe this, you know, what is so convincing to you? And a lot of the times people don't realize then what they even believe. Like a lot of people are indoctrinated into it. Their parents believed it and they taught them, you know, Jesus loves you. You're going to ascend into heaven. You just have to repent for your sins and, you know, not have sex till marriage and not be gay and not do any of these things. But it's like, how did you determine that that's right? How is that the right one? How do you know that that's the word of God? I don't know how you're coming to that conclusion. We don't even know who wrote the Bible. We don't know.
Yeah. But if you were to put religion aside, infinite intelligence, mm-hmm. is there a possibility of that? Do you believe the universe is intelligent?
I see no reason to believe that. I mean, like I myself, I've tried being like a psychic, you know, I looked up these videos on how you can access the Akashic records and stuff like that. And
yeah, you even had someone on your show that's on.
Yeah.
Akashic
yeah.
Records.
I actually had Debbie Solaris who's a Akashic record reader and ET contactee. And, yeah, she was on the Gaia program and all kinds of stuff. And I talked to her about what she believes. She's so nice. I love Debbie Solaris, but, and you know, me and my wife even went to a psychic and I was able to record my entire, conversation with the psychic. My wife yeah. wasn't able to record hers with hers, but, yeah, it's just, I see no reason. For me, it's a lot of claims being made. And once again, I'm an evidential person. If you can show me like, I don't know, neurological evidence that our brain or that our mind ascends past death. Awesome, you know, but I don't really know how you could prove that. And I don't really know if it's possible to prove that. For me, I feel like the evidence doesn't really give a shit about any of us or anybody. I mean, like people who say that like Mercury is in retrograde. So I feel like shit this week or something, or, oh boy, work is going to be rough because the moon
yeah.
is, you know, this position or something, or I was born at this particular day on this certain time. But where did you learn that that's true? Like, I understand what you believe and that you believe that, but how did you determine that that is real? What did you read that convinced you? Who did you talk to? What was, you know, put in front of you? Because I want to know. I want to try it. I want to do it. But it's.
So you walked away from these readings still skeptical.
Yes. Yeah. For me, like with, you know, Debbie Solaris didn't give me an actual reading. I think she actually requires payment for hers. So
right.
You know, so I unfortunately didn't get a reading from her, but maybe if I coax her a little bit more, I can get her to give me a free one. Maybe
yeah.
some little sweet talk, but
I mean, that's the thing I was going to ask too. Do you, when you have someone like Debbie on, and this is something I've battled on my show a ton, mm-hmm. Which is how much do you debate? How much do you, I mean, I really do try to understand and I try to throw my skepticism at them, but sometimes there's a part of me on the inside, Calvin, that's going, oh, but I could really question that belief even more. And I could really yeah. question it to the point where you might not enjoy having a further conversation with me. How do you strike that balance? What is your, how do you wrestle with that?
Yeah, debating is still a big problem that I'm working through. As a street epistemologist, you're supposed to walk away from debates. As soon as things start to get heated and uncomfortable is when you're supposed to say, okay, we're going to have to stop this now. We're going to have to continue on a different day, or we're both a little bit more level-headed. So street epistemology is not at all about debate is a thing. And that's something that I was just talking to Anthony Magnabosco about. it doesn't get you anywhere. You know, it just leaves both of you angry. And I've kind of found that, you know, like yesterday I noticed, yesterday I mentioned that I got banned from this Bigfoot group. And it's because I was practicing street epistemology one of the admins of the group actually posted some pictures of evidence that he thought was evidence, empty peanut butter jars, pictures of the forest with nothing in the background.
Right.
And I was practicing street epistemology, you know, what makes you so sure that a Bigfoot got to the peanut butter jar and not a raccoon or a squirrel? What makes you so sure? And he took the aggressive standpoint because people don't like being asked why they believe these things unwelcomed. You know, it's they're not expecting to be questioned, especially it's easier to do it in person because people can hear your tone of voice and see your body language, see that you're being welcome,
right,
not challenging them. This guy got very aggressive. I kind of switched into, that's my thing, is once people start getting aggressive towards me is when like I'll, you know, start throwing Bible verses back at you, the ones that you probably won't be a big fan of or things like that. And that's something that I'm trying to work through.
Throw Bible verses at people as like,
if it's a religious thing, cause most of the time these debates that I'm having with people and these street epistemology conversations is with religious people. So most of the time, right, they'll throw, John 3:16 or something at me, some, you know, loving, awesome verse or something. And I'll throw like Leviticus 22 or something at them where it talks all about slavery and beating your slaves and stuff.
Right.
So it starts a little poop throwing, and I'm kind of growing to not do that. I'm still working on it myself. And Anthony Magnabosco gave me some pointers on how not to do that. I have a little work to do, but I do welcome a debate. On my podcast, I try not to. I specifically tell my guests before they're on the show, I'm not looking to debate. I want you to tell me what you believe and why. And, you know, we can talk about the evidence and maybe a little bit why I may or may not believe what you believe. And they're usually like, yeah, okay, sure. If it's not a debate, I'm open to it. But there have been a couple occasions, like the Flat Earth interview, where I kind of start off a little street epistemology type of aspect, but it gets a little bit heated as the interview goes on. Out of frustration that I just felt like she wasn't understanding what I was saying, that it was just going in one ear, not the other. But at the same time, I feel like I could have been doing the same thing to a lot of things that she had been saying.
That's good. You're open. You're open to developing as a podcaster, as a person. So, I feel that too. It's a lot of pressure.
It's not a debate platform. That's the whole thing, is that you're welcome to come on and we can talk about what you believe and why. But if it starts to get heated, it starts to get heated. You know, sometimes I do preface a couple guests like, hey, look, this could get heated. I'm just letting you know, like even with the Flat Earth girl, I let her know. I was like, look, this could get heated. She said, I'm open to debate. And I said, okay, fine, then she's on. And if it gets debatey, it gets debatey. But it more so was her presenting her evidence for it and me just kind of critiquing it. I didn't have anything to present, you know, I'm just kind of critiquing what she had to say just based off of my top of the head knowledge. And I still feel like even with her arguments, they weren't quite strong enough for me to waive my belief at all. I try to stay open-minded and I try not to debate, but sometimes I get heated.
Yeah. I have to ask about this because I'm just so curious your take on it. The Westall UFO incident.
Yes.
Very curious what your thoughts are on for that. I also, there's that school in Zimbabwe, right?
Yes. Where, yeah, the aerial school phenomenon. Yep.
Yes. So both of those incidents are, for me at least, very compelling stories of a mass group of people seeing UFOs and even encountering extraterrestrials. What is your take on those kind of incidents?
Yeah, so the mass sightings one is kind of what interests me the most, is the mass sightings of things.
Yeah.
Individual accounts, like individual anecdotal accounts, like one guy alone in the forest saw Bigfoot, took this picture. Not strong enough for me, but when you say 300 people of all different age groups and all around the city saw it, that's when I might start to look at it a little closer.
Yeah. You know, and for those that don't know, yeah, what would you, I mean, can you sum up the Westall incident briefly or the
aerial? Yeah. Real briefly, I think it was in the 60s. I think it was 1966. There was the Westall School in Victoria, Australia, which is just outside of Melbourne. It essentially, there were some kids who ran into a classroom in a panic, said, "Hey, there's like a UFO or something outside, guys." And so all these kids were like, "What the hell?" They got up out of their seats, they looked out the window, and sure enough, in the distance, there was a literal UFO, is what this classroom of kids said. By the time this classroom of kids ran outside, there was a large group of 200 to 300 people, teachers, parents, kids. They're in their cars, they're in the classrooms, they're in the street, and they're looking at this thing in the sky. And they're like, "What the hell is this thing?" A couple of these kids actually dart towards the UFO. And they jump this fence to a place called the Grange Reserve, which is like a little foresty kind of area, which is now a little park. And these kids jumped it. This UFO landed, and there were three or four kids who actually jumped the fence and were face to face with this craft that supposedly landed. And nobody got out of it. They said that they didn't see any windows. They described the common UFO that you would think of, you know, a saucer shape, lights around the edges, so on,
right,
so silver, right, reflective. And they said there was one girl, her name was Tanya, and she actually fainted she got like a little too close or something, and she like screamed and then she fainted. And then she was dragged off of the Grange Reserve from these other kids that were there.
Oh my God.
And she was supposedly taken to a hospital and never seen again. Her best friend said that she went to her house and where she lived, because she was her best friend. She went to her house. She said an English woman answered the door. And it was an English woman speaking English. And she said, "I don't know who you're talking about. Those people have never lived here." And she said, "Dude, my friend has lived here for like 5-10 years. Like I knew where this is where she lives." She said, "I don't know what you're talking about." She closed the door.
That is insane.
Now, Tanya has since resurfaced. Her friend who actually has been on the news, and all these people who jumped the fence have actually been on the news.
Yeah.
She said that she has contacted Tanya through her lawyer. Actually, her lawyer actually found Tanya, contacted her, and said that she doesn't want to be on camera, and she just doesn't want to talk about it anymore, and she doesn't want to be friends. So apparently this Tanya does exist, but we don't have a last name. We don't have a street that she lived on, the house that it was. So that whole Tanya story is a little weird for me, because it's very anecdotal for me, for this one girl.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much about that is true, but the fact that these 200 to 300 students, teachers, they were on the news and they were like, "Dude, I don't know what the hell that thing was, but it was like nothing I've seen before." And it's just really weird. And it left a impression in the dirt, actually circular impression in the, like a little crop circle under it. Once it took off into the sky, and right where that crop circle is, there's actually now like a UFO slip and slide type of thing for kids to play on in the park. It's pretty funny looking.
That is.
Yeah. So the UFO, that incident, and like the Phoenix lights in 1997, stuff like that is really compelling to me.
So you have not found any, what are the skeptical points to the Westall and in the aerial one in Zimbabwe, which, I believe what's different about the aerial one, right, is that they actually saw and communicated with them.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, there's supposedly like little gray men in, silver shiny shoes, or maybe they were orange. I can't remember, but they stepped out of this craft and actually interacted with a couple of the kids. Yeah. And then they supposedly went on their way. And I don't know a ton about that one. I should do an episode on that one, though, and look more into it. I wrote a blog about it years ago, but
I mean, how can you, what would even the skeptic point be to that? Oh, it was, I don't even know what it could be.
For me, it would be like, for example, the Westall UFO incident. That was the 60s. Cameras did exist in the 60s. And you're telling me not a single person in that area got a photograph of a UFO. Right. Like, not a single person had a camera anywhere near them. The school didn't have one camera in it.
Right, right. But then for so many, what could a skeptic say that so many people?
Like a little Polaroid camera makes nowhere, really? Like, but yeah, 300 people. It's just,
that's, you know, what's weird.
How did that happen? And kids, I mean, kids are kids, you know, is the thing. So as far as the kids' accounts and them jumping the fence and getting sent to the hospital, I don't know about all of that because kids are kids and they like to lie and they like to go up with the mass hysteria of things. And so, you know, because they just don't understand what they're talking about. But it's a little weird for me. But even nowadays, the kids that were once kids, they still stand by their story 100%. And they say there was a craft there. So I'm just kind of the where I don't have enough evidence. You know, it's all anecdotal. There's no photographs. There's no pieces of it. There's no DNA. There was no laser beams. You know, it's just anecdotal. Same thing with like the Tic Tac UFO that's being a big thing right now. It's just a video. You know, there's not like, I mean, it's cool. It's interesting. But I don't feel like it's enough to solidly conclude that it's a flying craft from outer space. That's a big jump.
Yeah. Okay. You know what? Here, I want to talk about some stuff you haven't talked about on your show.
Okay.
Which is, I'm curious about what your thoughts are on the New World Order, the Illuminati, the idea of the Federal Reserve and people in the background in charge and pulling the strings. I do believe there's a lot of compelling evidence that the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and people that these big name players were involved in, wars on both sides. But then again, I don't know how compelling the evidence is because I probably saw it from a YouTube video years ago. But you can trace a lot of things back to these big powerful families. Do you think that there are people at the top pulling the strings of society? What's your take?
I mean, I think to an extent, yes. You know, I think that the Rothschilds definitely had some weird stuff going on with them, and they were being really, you know, creepy and, you know, putting their hands in a little bit of everything. I do believe that that's the case for them. As far as like the Illuminati, I'm not sure how much I believe in like that or like the Bohemian Grove or anything that they've heard of. You've heard of that.
I was gonna say, do you think they were just a bunch of people hanging out and
just like thinking that they're all just like a bunch of devil worshipers or something is like, it's a little weird.
It's very extreme.
And people like Alex Jones claims that he's actually been to Bohemian Grove and he did all this like a whole podcast or something at Bohemian Grove. I'm like, come on, dude, like, come on, man. Like, I just,
And
like, no, you didn't. He's like, there's Hillary Clinton right there in the background. I'm like, shut the fuck up. Like, you're totally lying, dude. I don't feel like it's to any extent to where it's like a new world order, like it's all for control. Because once again, what are they controlling? You know, what, I mean, besides money, I guess. It just doesn't make sense to me. Like, where is like the point in government where they, you know, anoint you into Illuminati? Like, when do you get that promotion to where they're like, all right, here's the secret, you know, like we're going to, you know, here we go. This is the New World Order. This is, you know, Kathy and collections for, you know, Illuminati. But it's like,
yeah, it's a good question.
When do you like learn about it and how do you learn about it? Like, who tells you? Who, like, what qualifies you for the Illuminati? How can they, like, not a single person has ever like spoken out and been like, look, dude, there's this, you know, secret society and New World Order. Like, there's never been.
Do you think there is anything to the secret societies beyond the fraternity? I did always wonder about that in colleges and Skull and Bones and all these things. They make it seem like it's something sacred and occultic, but I don't know.
It's like, I mean, because from that standpoint, it's like there's people who are in government of all different religions. You know, there's so that would mean that all these people with different religions in government are lying about their religion because they're following this secret religion, this Illuminati, whatever the Illuminati worships or whoever they worship. Or that means like the Muslims that are in government and in, you know, very high positions in government who probably would have access to this type of information. The fact that they don't share the same belief systems as them, but yet they do, but secretly, I don't know. It seems a little weird to me.
Yeah, that's a good point about the religious stuff. I've never thought about it that way. Also, what do you think about the occult symbols in pop culture? Does that mean anything? Or is it just pattern seeking?
I feel like it's probably a lot of pattern seeking, to be completely honest. I think we look for things that we want to see. You know, someone wants to find an occult symbol in something, they'll find something that's shaped like that. There are a couple things that were a little weird to me. I can't think of any particular ones off the top of my head, but I do remember there were a couple symbols and stuff that are like weird to me, but it's not any more compelling than like playing Stairway to Heaven backwards and hearing them talk about the devil. You know, it's no different than that.
What do you think about when people do the eye thing, the Illuminati eye thing, where they put the fingers in?
That, I don't even know what to think about. Like the people doing like the weird like gestures or whatever.
Yeah.
I feel like once again, that's a lot of pattern seeking, you know, the just straight up hoax. I don't know. It's just, once again, it's just not enough evidence to believe that they're part of this occult or something. It could be, maybe they all just were like, hey guys, let's do this. You know, what if this is funny? Or maybe it's an inside joke or something.
I'm trying to catalog here based on everything you've told me. I guess I'm trying to catalog and track where you are on the skeptic to believer thermometer for all these things. I'm going, okay, UFOs. He's kind of in the middle. Alien, ancient, advanced technology, higher.
Even
higher.
Better, yeah. I'd say I'm like 90% sure that there's some sort of ancient lost technology.
Yeah.
Just love that 10% where I'm like, I don't know, convince me, you know, show me how they built this.
They haven't shown
how these things are built with the copper chisels and
right,
you know, stone hammers. They haven't done it because they can't.
Yeah.
So it's like, I'm about 90% sure until they show me that they can build these things with the technology, which they have not yet done.
Lizard people, you're completely on the other side of now. You're a skeptic.
Oh yeah. No, I don't know about no lizard people, but
what about the UFOs? What about Antarctica? This is one I've been bringing up a lot with people these days. Antarctica, the Nazis going there after World War II, UFOs, Admiral Byrd. You ever go into that stuff?
Yeah. I looked into some of that stuff and I think there's a lot of truth behind it. I feel like they very well, you know, could have went to Antarctica and maybe attempted to do something, but the truth of the matter is that it's freaking cold there and it's damn near hard to survive there. So the fact that they would have some sort of secret base there and plan to keep it running in the early 40s, where we, you know, didn't even have much of the technology we have today, just getting the hang of cars and stuff. And yet we're building massive bases on the coldest place on Earth to build UFO technology, but yet we've just made cars. I don't know. It's
that's a good
point. Like cars are literally at that point, cars were like 40 years old. Like they had just started making cars basically. I feel like they could have went to Antarctica, but whether they actually did anything there is a little bit of a stretch.
What about any technology that's advanced? Do you think the government has UFO technology? Do you think they have time travel or teleportation technology?
Now, see, this is, as far as teleportation technology, I don't know. That's I haven't really looked a ton into that. I looked into like the Philadelphia Project and Project Pegasus and stuff like that, which are kind of touch on it a little bit. But as far as like us having technology, I would say I believe we have some sort of flying technology that is not released. But I feel like you know, that could go for really anything. Like we didn't know about the stealth fight until it was found. Someone saw it in the sky. You know, someone saw this giant black stealth fighter and was like, what the fuck is that? That looks like a UFO. And the government was like, oh, you caught us. It's actually a plane we've been working on. Sorry, but here it is. You know, here, you found it. Yeah, so that's why we even know about the stealth fighter. Otherwise, we might not even know about it today. Because they kind of released it a little reluctantly, told us about it. Like people like Bob Lazar and stuff like that, who've claimed to work at like S4 and Area 51.
Yes.
He comes with very compelling evidence. Like the fact that Bob Lazar discovered, his team discovered the element 115 back in the 80s. And he was talking about it back in the 80s, but it wasn't until I think 2011 that the government formerly came out and said that we have created a new chemical called that we're going to call Element 115. It was, I can't remember the name of it, but it was the exact same name that Bob Lazar said in the 80s. So yeah. Bob Lazar literally knew about this 30, 40 years before they created it or announced it. Yeah. And the fact that Bob Lazar is a really interesting character.
I was going to say, like, what do you think about there's people very skeptical of him out there, you know, in addition to the whole, I mean, not that having a prostitution ring or being affiliated with one automatically makes you a complete liar about everything else you've done in your life. But people use that as evidence of shadiness. And then the idea that they can't find any records of him being at these schools that he claims he was in. And there's some contradictory evidence. I mean, what do you make of all that?
Well, for Bob Lazar, I'm pretty confident that he did actually work at that facility, because they're actually, I can't remember if it was like a news, I think it's like a newspaper article that's actually in the hallway of the school. And it actually says Robert Lazar, part of the staff, like right there in the paper, like his name is there. And I believe he's actually in like a picture in one of the articles too.
Yeah.
He's like, that's literally like, I literally work here. He's like, here's my degree hanging on my wall. He's like, I didn't, it's like, what, why, it's got the seal and everything. Like, I don't.
Yes.
And
he
walks into these colleges like it's the back of his hand. He walks in, he says, hey, what's up, Bob? You know, walking down hallways, he knows exactly where he's going. He says, this, you know, this hallway will take you down to the cafeteria. This will take you to this lab. This will take you to this lab. And he's right. You know, there's no, he knows where he's going in these buildings and the centers that he supposedly researched at. And the guy was building rockets on his bicycle before he was working at NASA. I mean, this guy was a genius. I feel it's very probable that he was recruited to work on some sort of technology. And that would kind of bring me to like the Roswell incident, 1947, the big Roswell crash in New Mexico.
What's your take?
I would say I feel like something happened. Something definitely happened. Whether it was alien or extraterrestrial, I don't know, but something definitely crashed. There's like the guy who took the pictures right after that, and they were like, oh, it's an air blimp or whatever. It's a weather balloon. The guy who took the pictures, can't think of his name, but he took the pictures with this weather balloon. He's still actually alive. And even today he says, I totally was bullshitting that. I was told to bullshit that. That was not what we found out there. I was given that in that building right there. And they told me, take pictures with this and act surprised. So even today, you know, and he's still pretty put together guy. He's not like senile or anything. He's just a farmer guy now. But he says like, that was not the case. Like, we did find something. So even the guy who took the pictures came out in a recent documentary called The Phenomena is what it's called.
Yes, yes.
And that's a really, really interesting information in that. So I suggest that to anyone who's interested in
it. Yeah, they do a whole section on the Westall thing too.
Yeah, yeah, they do. I was like, hey, I just, because it was literally right after I did that episode that movie dropped. And I was like, hey, what the hell? You guys still Westall?
Yeah.
But I think that something definitely crashed and we have something. I don't know whether it was a full-on craft. I'm skeptical saying that there was an alien in it, because a lot of people were like, oh, there's an alien in it. And he went to the, you know, this base in Ohio and, you know, was experimented on and stuff. But that's a little skeptical for me. But as far as the actual craft itself, something crashed. I don't know if it was maybe a full craft or if it was something, maybe a piece of a craft that they were able to reverse engineer or start reverse engineering. Or something like the Oumuamua that actually, within the past couple of years, the Oumuamua phenomena, I guess you could say, which is this giant comet that actually passed right by Earth. And we didn't even know it passed by us until it was almost out of our solar system. And it looks weird. It doesn't look like anything we know of today. So maybe there's theories that the Oumuamua comet or meteor, they're not sure what it was actually some sort of piece of alien technology or possibly a ship itself. Maybe something along those lines may have crashed into New Mexico in 1947. We were able to get some sort of material from that. But then people like Bob Lazar are stating that he was inside these crafts. He crawled up inside and he said there were little seats and there was like a little generator on the bottom. That's why it's kind of got the bulb on the top and on the bottom, because that the bottom is where all the the crazy stuff was happening, and that it would tilt sideways to fly around, and just really interesting stuff. So it's like, I don't know what really happened in 1947.
What do you think about the fact that I always was skeptical of Bob too, because he said, he keeps saying propulsion system as if that's the one technical term he knows. Right. I never feel that he goes, and maybe that's because you could say, well, the public doesn't understand the intricacies of physics, so he's not going to go into all that on Joe Rogan show or whatnot. But I've always felt that that strikes me as off. You could keep saying propulsion system and make it sound like it means something over and over, but I'm going, show me the physics genius that you are.
Right. Yeah, he's like stating how this thing works, but he's not like explaining the physics behind it. You know, he's saying like, this is how it works, but I don't have any of the math to support it. You know, and that, because like he stated before that essentially you're falling through space, you know, it's warping the space in front of you. And essentially the UFO is falling forward at a it's bending space time in front of it and falling forward. And it's just, that's why I can go these light speeds. But it's like, where's the math for that? Is that just a theory? Right. Or did you just come up with that off the top of your head? What makes you say that? So.
Yeah. No, it's definitely weird. Yeah. It's very compelling, all this stuff.
Yeah.
I wonder, is, you know, to put it all together here, everybody, first of all, you have to check out Unquestionable with Calvin Smith, available on all podcast platforms. But, you know, check it out. It's a lot of 14 episodes so far, but all various, very interesting topics.
So 15 coming out this Wednesday with Anthony Magnabosco.
Yes.
He used to be the president of Street Epistemology International, but now he's the executive director. So,
yeah, you know what? Now that I said this, I have no idea when this is coming out. You might have 50 episodes by the time this episode comes out. not to scare you too much. No, but seriously, I mean, this is, you've already covered such a wide range of interesting topics, Calvin.
Yeah.
And also you're a musician, which is, you know, are you, I know you have a single out. Yes. Okay. Do you bring any of the esoteric into your musicianship at all?
I mean, a little bit. You know, I'm a musician first and foremost. You know, when I was 9 years old is when I first picked up a guitar. And it wasn't until I was about 15, 16 that I decided that I wanted to start singing. And so, you know, now I've been playing singing ever since. And I'm working on setting up a live show at a bar down the street from me here. And then probably end of August, sometime around there. So if anyone's in Michigander, I think August 28th is kind of the date that we're thinking of. But we're not 100% sure. But I like to play with the audience, you know, a little bit. I would like to, you know, bring a couple aspects of my podcast. Like, I plan on wearing my shirt up there and promote myself, and you know, maybe educating the audience a little bit. You know, as long as they're not too intoxicated, maybe teach them a couple things about my podcast and street epistemology and you know, ancient technology is kind of, you know, transition into the next song, I guess you could say, or the next set. Kind of play with the crowd a little bit. But yeah, I'm a musician at heart. I've got my first single, Empty Room, out, and that's on all streaming platforms. That came out in February. And it's also on YouTube too. It's on my YouTube channel for my personal stuff, not the podcast page. And I've got a couple more songs written up. I'm just saving up the money right now to hit up the studio and get a couple more songs recorded so I can put out my first EP. And right now I have to finish up moving first. So
nice. Yeah, everybody check out Empty Room.
Yes.
At the end of all this, you're still a skeptic for the most part. You do believe that there are some unexplained things. Actually, yeah, is there anything we haven't covered that you consider unexplainable phenomena? I mean, I'm talking ghosts, I'm talking astral projecting, anything esoteric. Is there something out there that you're going, I do not have a rational explanation for why this happens, and it makes me think that perhaps there is something more than just placebo effect or people just convincing themselves of this. What else is out there?
Well, my kind of standpoint is it's okay to say I don't know. And that's my thing, is that, like, for example, like the Egyptology, the fact that they're so unwelcoming to new evidence that may counter the modern narrative of human civilization, you have to be able to say you don't know. And the fact that we're saying that we do know for a fact these things, we do know for a fact that God exists, we know for a fact that the Sphinx is 4,500 years old, we know for a fact that, aliens are flying around, something like that. It's okay to say that you don't know and that you don't have enough evidence to come to that conclusion. So I come from the standpoint where you have to be able to say you don't know, and it's okay to say you don't know. As far as like ghosts, I see no reason to believe in ghosts. You know, I have, you know, I would love for a ghost to pop up on me. I've been waiting my whole life for a ghost to show up for me. I'm anxious for this. I want them, like, come find me. I want to hang out.
Yeah.
I've done the ghost box thing where I've had ghost boxes and they're like going through frequencies and nothing's happened. Me and my sister have sat in the middle of a dark room for hours on end waiting for ghosts to contact us in a house we assumed to be haunted for no apparent reason. But nothing. So my thing is, I let the evidence speak for itself. If I feel like supernatural is something that we can't test for. We can't test for the supernatural. And I'm not even quite sure what supernatural means, or paranormal. We're not able to test for it. And there's no...
That's a good point too.
You know, why do we have to think that grandma is still watching over us? And why don't I see ghost dinosaurs? I don't know.
Yeah. And what about, I guess, do you... When people are going into Akashic records, or they're saying, I projected my body and astral projection, I guess, is another one. Do you think it's just a story people are telling themselves? I mean, what is your take on those more experiential spiritual phenomenon that are a little more esoteric and out there?
Well, like, as far as astral projection, there is some evidence that's coming out. I haven't read a ton into it, but I saw a couple articles that they've actually been testing astral projection in a lab and trying to get results from that. And apparently there's been some sort of result with that. I'll have to look into it once, you know, we're done talking, because I'm interested now about what the evidence had to say about that. But for me, people are scared to say that they don't know, or people are scared of death. People are scared of not knowing. So people come up with arbitrary explanations to things that they don't understand. And that's kind of the definition of faith, is pretending to know things that you know you don't know. So it's people are scared to say that they don't know. People want answers. People want to know where they're going after death. People don't want to think, when I die, that's it. Like, I can't even comprehend what nothingness is. You don't remember what happened before you were born. That's going to be what death is, in my opinion, at least, and based off of that current evidence that I know of, is that you close your eyes and that's it. You're not even going to know that you're dead necessarily. You're just going to be nothing. And that's scary. People want to continue and have, project into another reality where they can, you know, do whatever they want to do like that. But I feel like it's a lot of people, quite honestly, lying to themselves, being doxastically closed, which is not being open to new evidence, essentially, and just out of fear that they want answers.
Yeah, that's what I don't understand. I mean, this, and that's one of the things I've always said, and I feel that perhaps you're on a similar journey with me on these shows, that even if it isn't true what people believe, I am compelled by people that believe that it is. I'm trying to go, why do they think this? I mean, I've had two people recently that I spoke with, and I haven't even recorded the, well, I did one where I recorded an episode, but two people I spoke with that are channelers. And when they talk about channeling, they go, I have no idea. Something's going through me. Knowledge that I am not, after I say it, I don't remember saying what I said. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I could know these things about people. People ask me about this and I have no idea how. And skeptic Greg over here can go, okay, well, this is, in general, we have an unconscious mind that is capable of very powerful things that we aren't aware of picking up on. And maybe some people have a critical, I mean, this is what you do in hypnosis. You break down the critical faculty of the brain so that the unconscious and the conscious, there's no barrier between them. And some people may have just somehow gained a special advantage. They now have access, more direct access to their unconscious, and their unconscious intuitively picks up things about people that they wouldn't be able to, and is the creative part. Therefore, a channeler is really just a skilled actor with a basis in spirituality. That is an explanation I could have that would explain it. And then the flip side is someone could go, yes, but the idea of the unconscious in general itself is a channel from a higher. So I'm going, oh my gosh, this is just, it gets so confusing. You can talk in circles.
Yeah,
But at the same time, you know, hey, the fact that people are tuning into this frequency within themselves and bringing forth psychic claims, I'm curious what the specifics are, but saying things and accessing this and having no memory, that is something worth exploring to me. I guess it was a little rant here. I don't even know if I have a question. What would you do if someone were to come to you and say, hey, I channel, I speak things that I don't even know that I'm saying, and when I'm in that state, and I've also had hits, significant hits. I say things that there's no way I could have possibly known. Debunk it right now, Calvin. Tear it up. Why are they full of crap, if you think they are?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that they're full of crap. They could.
That's good. You're respectable. Young man.
Yeah, they very well, they can prove it to me. And that's the thing, is always being open. And even with how crazy it sounds, like I've had people tell me that there's dragons in Morocco and all kinds of crazy stuff. But I mean, no matter how crazy it sounds, you still have to stay open to it. And
right.
So my question for them would be is, how did you determine this to be true? Like, I understand how you practice it and how you do it, but how do you know that this is what you're doing? How do you know that it's not, some other phenomena that's going on? How do you know that you're not, I don't know, time traveling or something? I don't know. Like, how do you know that this astral projection or this psychic reading, how do you know that that's what you're doing? Or, I mean, are you just blatantly lying to me? Break down exactly what happens. Like, how do you start? How do you start training for it? And I had a really good discussion with Debbie Solaris about this. I did a lot of street epistemology with her. A lot of her answers back were, I don't know. You know, it's just, I don't know why this happens. It just does. And what's funny with her is that her abilities, I guess you could say, come from 2012, back when we all thought the world was going to end because of the Mayan calendar ending in December 21st. But she was scared of that. She was scared of the world ending. So she was researching things. She found stuff about psychic readings and astral projection and the Akashic records. She was like, interesting, okay, reading that stuff. And then she went to bed that night. Big hint, she went to bed. And then she projected into another reality where there were aliens and they taught her the Akashic records. And I'm like, okay, but how do you know that that wasn't just a dream?
Right.
What makes you say that you projected somewhere? Like, she said that she fell asleep and then immediately woke up, and then she fell asleep in this other realm. She woke up back at home, just knowing how to do this. How do you know what you were reading that night didn't just sit in your subconscious and you had a crazy dream about it? Why do you think that that's real? How can we test that that's real? That's for me, I mean, it has to be repeatable. and testable to hold up to that type of standard. I mean, saying they contacted some aliens and can access the Akashic records is quite a big claim. I mean, to be honest, I've watched a couple of her readings that she did. Like, she did a reading on George Norrie, and even George Norrie looked like he, like she was freaking crazy. So, yeah. And I mean, the psychic reading that I did with my wife, it was nothing psychic, I guess you could say. She did. She just kind of pulled some cards out, said, "Hey, this is what this card means. Oh, by the way, you're vitamin D deficient." I was like, "What? What? Why?" I was like, "I've never, like, what?" She's like, "You're vitamin D deficient. You need tons of vitamin. You need 5,000 international units of vitamin D." Luckily, I didn't listen to her, because I went home and looked it up, and doctors only recommend 400 to 500 international units. I could have freaking died. Well, I could have OD'd on vitamin D, quite literally. She said, because we live in Michigan, we get less sun exposure, so we were lower on vitamin D. I'm like, okay, but how do you know that I am low on vitamin D? How did you figure that out? Like, she's like, "Oh, well, the spirit behind you, your spirit guide told me." Okay, well, why didn't my spirit guide tell me? I want to know if I'm vitamin D deficient, if I'm dying or something. You know, why is he telling you to tell me? Why is this telephone going on?
Did she have a supplement store she could link you to, or a place in her bed?
No, she just kept saying that she wasn't a doctor, yet she kept telling me I was vitamin D deficient. I'm like, okay, so you're trying to be a doctor.
These people. That's scary stuff sometimes.
That's why I care what people believe and why, because people can, you know, people can believe things for all the wrong reasons. People can not even knowingly hurt somebody. If I would have taken 5,000 international units of vitamin D, I may not have died, depending on where my, you know, levels are now. That's the thing, is I don't know if I'm normal or not anyways. I hardly get any sun. And if I would have taken 5,000 units, I mean, it probably would have made my stomach really freaking upset. And I probably would have felt like crap for a couple days, or at least until my, you know, vitamins worked through me. Probably would have been peeing a lot, but, but I just, that's why I care what people believe, because if they're enforcing, essentially she was enforcing her belief on me. She was saying, "My belief is telling me that you are vitamin D deficient, so you need to take more vitamin D." That could hurt somebody. She said, "You know, you're low, you know, you're low on iron or something," and they take a shit ton of iron, and then they, you know, they have some problems with their health that way. So it's, I only care what people believe when they try to enforce it on other people. That's mostly why I stand so firmly on, like, separation of church and state. And I try to practice in activism as much as I can and do street epistemology, because I want to know, if you believe this, is that belief reliable, truthful, and is it harming others? So that's mostly what I'm thinking of.
Yeah. Well, look, I appreciate the work you're doing. I really am. Everybody, first of all, check out Empty Room. Calvin Smith's music. Definitely hope to hear more of that. That's out there. But also, Unquestionable with Calvin Smith, interviewing all sorts of people. And look, if you know what, you don't even have to be a psychic. If you have a PhD and can give Calvin a proper reading of his nutrient imbalances, please, he might interview you. He'll let you come on the show. He needs to know right now. You're so intelligent, Calvin. You really know this stuff. And I'm so happy you're out there doing this. This has been great. I really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really do appreciate you. And I had an awesome time talking to you about all this types of stuff, and trust me, I have so much more to talk about. So you're welcome to.
I would love to have you on again. Yes. At all. If we get a debate going, would you ever debate anybody on the show?
It depends. Honestly, if you can set up a debate, because I haven't seen a debate on ancient technology. And this flat Earth woman, Robin, once again, love her. She's very nice. She is trying to debunk my ancient technology. She's trying to send me stuff. This is how they built the pyramids. This is how they built it. And we're debating about ancient technology. So we're kind of flipping. She's questioning me now.
Oh my gosh.
So it's really interesting. We're having a cordial debate through text message right now. But yeah, I mean, if you can have like a debate, whether it be on ancient technology or even religion, because you know, I've read the Bible pretty thoroughly and, you know, I'm still learning today. And yeah, I mean, I would probably be open to it. I would definitely look into it.
Yo, okay. Maybe I need to get you and Robin on the show and just see what happens. And you know what? Let's that heat you were feeling with her, let's just crank it up even higher. Yes. The fiery pits of skeptic hell are going to be.
Boy, because the amount of pictures I have, the amount of things I've written about that I don't have on the podcast that I just have in my personal records.
Yes,
the connections to people that I know. You know, I'm going to be talking to a couple of ancient civilization researchers and people like that. So it's going to be interesting for sure.
Oh my gosh, that is such a tease. We got to do it. Awesome, Calvin Smith. Thanks so much for coming on. This has been great.
Thank you so much, Greg.
Calvin. Thanks so much for coming on the show, friend. Everybody, you have to listen to his podcast. He's doing the good work. Also, in a little under 2 hours, did Calvin just debunk everything that's happened so far in all 154 of these episodes? What is my meaning of life? I think Calvin just took me back to street existentialism again. I'm kidding. I love having the challenge. And I appreciate you being there with me. Talk to you soon.